From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Yesterday was Hitler's birthday, and no one in Littleton, Colorado will ever forget it. At least 15 people are dead after two students opened fire at a Denver area high school, the deadliest school shooting in the nation's history. President Clinton urged the nation's youth to resolve their conflicts with words, not weapons. This, as U.S. bombs fall on Belgrade. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Police are revising downward the number of dead at Colorado's Columbine High School, the scene of horrific violence yesterday. Officials in suburban Denver now say at least 15 people are dead after two students opened fire on their classmates. That include the shooters, who apparently killed themselves. A sheriff's department spokesman says two or three bodies were found outside the school, and 12 are believed to be inside. Officers have delayed removing the bodies until today because of possible booby traps. Police found bombs in and around the school, including in two cars in the school parking lot. As for the injured, sheriff spokesman Steve Davis says he knows of 20 people being taken to hospitals. He says all are in critical condition. Last night, President Clinton addressed the nation at a news conference in Washington, saying, "We do know that we must do more to reach out to our children and teach them to express their anger and to resolve their conflicts with words, not weapons." Yet in Belgrade, NATO missiles slammed into a Belgrade high-rise today, setting top floors ablaze in an attack on the offices of Yugoslavia's ruling party. The United States rushed more troops and equipment into Albania as border clashes raise fears of an expanding Balkan war. A dozen Apache anti-tank helicopters intended to bolster NATO's ability to assault Yugoslav ground forces in Kosovo left their base in Italy today en route for Albania, with another dozen expected to follow within a day. Amid concerns the conflict may spread, the president of Montenegro, Yugoslavia's smaller republic, was reported today to have rejected demands by the Yugoslav army that he put his republic's police force under Belgrade's control. Along other tense borders, Croatia charged that Yugoslavia had moved up to 300 troops into a UN-controlled demilitarized zone between Croatia and Montenegro, and Yugoslav troops wounded an Albanian soldier in a firefight along that southern border. This news from Puerto Rico. "Get the Navy out," the protesters shouted. Puerto Rico's governor said the same thing, this time in a letter to President Clinton. Shocked at the accidental killing Monday of a civilian by U.S. jets training for Kosovo, Puerto Rican politicians and residents alike are demanding that Clinton end some 60 years of bombings, shellings, and strafings on the island of Vieques. The Navy controls 75% of the land on the island of nearly 10,000 residents, including some of Puerto Rico's best beaches and fishing grounds. U.S. and foreign troops conduct exercises there an average 235 days of the year. The governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Rosello, said today in an impassioned letter to Clinton, "Regretfully but emphatically, I must by this means request you order the immediate and permanent cessation of United States and allied activities that entail the use of weaponry." He went on to say no community of American citizens should have to endure such conditions. Two Marine F-18 jets on a night training mission launched 500-pound bombs that hit an observation post Monday night, killing David Sanes Rodriguez, a 35-year-old guard. Three other civilians and a military observer were injured by flying glass as the post's windows crashed in. The jets were based on the USS John F. Kennedy, which is practicing for an assignment to the Adriatic Sea to relieve forces fighting in Kosovo. Reports that landmines are being laid in Kosovo and Angola add new urgency to a conference to chart the next steps in implementing the world ban on the deadly devices. The issue of new mines is expected to be a major topic at the first conference on the landmine treaty since it went into effect March 1st. Mozambique, which has established 2 million landmines from its civil war, is hosting the May 3rd through 7th meeting in its capital, Maputo. The treaty, which was drafted in December of 97, has already been signed by 135 countries and ratified by 72, a near record number in such a short time. The United States and Russia, however, are not one or two of those countries. A significant number of draft dodgers are among more than 20,000 refugees from Yugoslavia who streamed across the border into Bosnia-Herzegovina, this according to the UN Special Representative to Bosnia. Elizabeth Wren had no estimate of the number of draft dodgers, but said that quite a number of young men crossing into Bosnia have told authorities they don't want to be drafted and that that is the reason that they are coming. The draft dodgers include Muslim Slavs, Serbs, and others. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Thank you, Amy. And is it just me, but 12 Apache helicopters have arrived in the Balkans, and no one is thinking about the absolute irony of Apache helicopters being sent by the United States to prevent ethnic cleansing. Geronimo must be turning over in his grave.
Just think about that, folks. Well, yesterday was Hitler's birthday, and at Columban High School in Littleton, just outside Denver, it was marked by the deadliest school shooting in U.S. history. As junior Evan Vitale said about the shooters, they always have the neo-Nazi look, so we were talking about them and Hitler's birthday even before the shooting started. Everybody knew it was Hitler's birthday. The teenagers laughed and hooted as they opened fire on classmates in their suburban Denver high school, killing at least 16 people and then apparently turning their semi-automatic weapons on themselves. According to witnesses, the two marched into the library of Columban High School with guns and pipe bombs and began shooting students and faculty, holding the school under siege for several hours. As survivors of the shooting left the school, many said the two gunmen were part of a clique called the Trenchcoat Mafia. Students also said that they targeted kids of color and popular athletes. In their video production class, one student said they shot videos of themselves holding guns and that they'd already threatened to kill people in the past. In a front-page Washington Post piece today, entitled Trenchcoat Cliques Savor Death Fantasy, the article says, on websites featuring poetry called The Written Work of the Trenchcoat, trenchcoats serve as a symbol for things from Hitler and the Nazis to mass murder to suicidal fantasies. Yesterday was Hitler's birthday, the article goes on to say, an occasion for demonstrations, mock funerals, and other macabre commemorations among both Nazis and parts of the Gothic scene. When asked whether stricter gun control is needed, Colorado Governor Bill Owens, a Republican whose election platform included the liberalization of concealed weapon laws, replied yesterday, "I'm not going to get into this. These are kids still in the school, and we'll talk about that later." Well, in fact, the shooting came as the Colorado state legislature is close to enacting new gun legislation liberalizing state laws for carrying concealed weapons. Yesterday, a House panel had planned to take up the measure today, but legislative leaders decided to postpone action in light of yesterday's shootings. It also came just 2 weeks before the National Rifle Association holds its annual convention, this one to be held in Denver. President Clinton spoke about the shooting last night in an address to the nation, saying, "We do know that we must do more to reach out to our children and teach them to express their anger and to resolve their conflicts with words, not weapons." Well, we'll get to the bombing of Yugoslavia later, but we're going to start off right now by talking about the school shooting. and all that it entailed. We're joined by a number of people from around the country. Among them, Patrick Sheehan, who is a 17-year-old junior at the Norwich Academy in Norwich, Connecticut, who's part of the group Youth Peace that focuses on violent influences on young people. Vince Schiraldi and Josh Sugarman are with us in our Washington studio. Vince from the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, who's done a study of schoolhouse shootings. Josh Sugarman with the Violence Policy Center. And Mark Potok joins us from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who looks at neo-Nazi groups around the country. Let's begin with Patrick Sheehan. You're in Norwich, Connecticut, Patrick. What was your response when you heard yesterday about the shootings in Littleton?
First, I was surprised. It just kind of taken aback by it. I was watching TV, and I just, this kind of thing takes a bit to register to my mind. But after thinking about it some more, it was just sad. A very lonely feeling.
Patrick, we're also joined by Isolde Rafferty, who is a 17-year-old junior as well, but from Garfield High School in Seattle. She's with Students Against Violence Everywhere, called SAVE. And in 1995, there was a shooting in her school in which two girls were injured, and one of them formed the SAVE chapter in Garfield. Isolde, welcome to Democracy Now! So you are, in a way, reliving what you experienced or what your community experienced just 4 years ago.
Definitely. We are so angered right now by what's going on. I've talked to some friends, and everybody's just almost hysterical. We're saying, you know, how many of us is it going to take to have to be killed before somebody opens up and says, this needs to stop? You know, we need to look at legislators. It's horrible. We're really, really angry.
Well, Isolde Rafferty, I'd like to ask you, there's all kinds of speculation about the influence of a possible Hitler adulation, the influence of a possible Leonardo DiCaprio movie. What are some of the pressures and influences that you see are affecting young people in terms of the use of violence in America?
Big influence, like video games, movies. Yeah, it's all horrible. You know, it all focuses on violence. But at the same time, I think a lot of times the adults in this country tend to look, you know, what is it that's doing it? And you don't see this type of brutal massacre happening in Europe. And I think it's happening because there's so little gun control. People like the NRA are ruling this country. This society is really twisted right now. And it's not okay. I think that we need to look more towards ourselves than, oh, gee, it's the media. Okay, it's so-and-so. We put the blame on everybody else. And that's not what we're supposed to do. We need, like, I think Clinton was right. We need to address emotional values as well, but that's not going to cut it. We need to address what's going on in the legislation.
Well, Isolde, as we said, we're also joined by Josh Sugarman, Executive Director of the Violence Policy Center. Mm-hmm. And it's quite something that today, in the Colorado State Legislature, the House panel was actually going to take up the issue of liberalizing concealed weapons, the laws around them in Colorado. In fact, the state Senate had already passed the law that would liberalize them. Josh Sugarman, can you go through for us what's happening now in Colorado and the role of the governor, who did not want to talk about gun control yesterday? Josh, are you with us? Well, then let's go to Mark Potok on the phone, and we'll get Josh with us in just a second. Mark is from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Mark's on to talk about a different aspect of this story. And that is something that, you know, Juan, I was really shocked by, and that is that early in the day yesterday, when we were listening to the media coverage, at one point I heard a Colorado TV anchor say, they're targeting kids of color and kids who wear white hats or sports caps and athletes. And I thought, wait, did I hear something? What did I just hear? And then it took hours before I ever heard it mentioned again. And it was a girl who had just come out of the school. She was completely traumatized. And she said, he was shooting people right in front of me. He was shooting people of color and people who play sports. And then she said she begged him not to shoot her. He had put a gun in her mouth, she said. And then he shot the boy the black boy who was next to her, she said, because he was black. Mark Potok is with us from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, you monitor neo-Nazi groups. Can you talk a little about the Colorado scene?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I've heard unconfirmed reports that some of the shooters were yelling 420, 420, meaning April 20th, which was, of course, yesterday's date and Hitler's birthday. You know, my impression from looking at the coverage of this in some detail is that, you know, this was a part, you know, kind of Hitler worship was a part of the whole Gothic scene, this sort of death cult, and I think it's somewhat related to death metal and all of that. You know, how serious these kids may have been about the Hitler aspect, I think is very questionable. You know, I don't think we're looking at a real sort of National Socialist group at the high school in Littleton. I don't think that really appears to be the case. So I'm really not sure, you know, how much that has to do with this case. It sounded to me like black kids were getting shot, but it may have had more to do with the fact that they were associated with athletic teams and kids who were considered sort of, you know, prom queen types, the popular kids in schools, in the school by the shooters. So I really think it remains to be seen if there's a strong sort of Hitler, you know, Nazi angle to this.
But Mark, at least all the reports that I've seen this morning do indicate that there was a great degree of Hitler worship, an apparent degree of Hitler worship among these kids. Isn't it, to some degree, even more frightening that they're not, that they weren't necessarily part of an organized group, but that this is the kind of stuff that in some areas of the country is now beginning to reach young people?
No question. I think that, you know, where you're seeing this kind of enter high school culture in a big way is through music. You know, the sort of death metal scene as it verges into the Gothic scene, it does involve a certain extent of Hitler worship. You know, all I'm trying to say is that, you know, this is not like many of the groups we look at. It doesn't look to be, you know, an organized National Socialist group. I think it's more, it looks more culty, involved in, you know, sort of ideas of death. And, you know, and Hitler comes quickly into that sort of pantheon of, you know, of heroes because of his association with death and dark themes and so on.
I thought it was also very interesting that one of the kids was quoted in the papers and in the television saying that in their video production class that one of these kids had filmed himself with a lot of guns, which brings us to that issue of guns. Josh Sugarman from the Violence Policy Center is with us in Washington. Let's go back to that issue of state laws in Colorado and the really sad irony that today a House panel was taking up something the Colorado State Senate already passed, and that was liberalization of the handgun concealment laws in Colorado, something that Bill Owens, the Colorado governor, was a plank he ran on. Josh.
Good morning. Well, what we found is that, you know, Colorado has relatively very weak laws compared to other states. In fact, under Colorado law, youth are allowed to possess rifles and shotguns legally, and that although it's a misdemeanor to possess a handgun. In fact, this morning, Governor Owen did say that he thinks the legislature should reconsider their views regarding this concealed carry law. And I think what we're going to find is that, you know, just 2 weeks ago, Missouri rejected a concealed carry measure. And I think, you know, for anybody to argue that situations like Littleton and other school shootings, the answer is to put more guns out there. I think hopefully that'll begin to ring more and more false. But my real concern is that I think we have to recognize that the problem in Littleton and other schools isn't that we don't have enough metal detectors. It's not music. It's not kids going bad. It's the fact that there are too many guns out there, and kids have too ready access to them.
Josh, we have to break for stations to identify themselves as we take on this horrific story of the shootings in Littleton, Colorado, at the Columbine High School, a Denver suburb. We're talking to Josh Sugarman, who's with the Violence Policy Center. He's executive director, as well as Isolde Rafferty, a 17-year-old junior in Garfield High School in Seattle, Patrick Sheehan, 17-year-old junior at Norwich Academy in Norwich, Connecticut, and will be joined also by other people talking about the issue of guns. Mark Potok also on the phone from the Southern Poverty Law Center. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
War? War wears the bones of orphans from the Sudan. War has stacks and stacks of legs from Angola. War is wrapped in silk from Cambodia. War walks on walking sticks from Burundi. War is hiding its emaciated bodies in Sarajevo. War sits and twirls its fingers on borders of the former Soviet Union. War eats through human faces in Sri Lanka. War is dressed like a warlord from Somalia. War drapes its head with cloth from India. War soaks its feet in sweet oils from the Middle East. War has a breath that smells of putrid metals and chemicals from North America. War is a seller of ethnic cleansers. War is a collector of religious symbols. War has dreams made of massacres. War has eyes made of stones from outer space. War is devoted to war.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. At least 15 people dead at a Littleton, Colorado high school, the Columban High School in suburban Denver, as two gunmen opened fire and carried bombs into the school. They were or had been students of the school, and many of the students there who were running away from them, who escaped, described them as neo-Nazis or part of a neo-Nazi clique, which was informally called the Trenchcoat Mafia because all of the guys in this clique wore black trench coats. Well, we're taking on this issue with a number of people around the country, just speaking with Josh Sugarman, executive director of the Violence Policy Center, about laws in Colorado. And the statement this morning of the Republican governor of Colorado saying he was reconsidering his stance, calling for liberalization of gun concealment laws. Now, interestingly enough, in a Colorado paper this morning, the state senator who sponsored the bill said that this wouldn't have happened, Josh, if there was a teacher in the school who was carrying a weapon that people could see. What do you think about that?
I think anybody who makes that argument, I think we've gotten to the point in this country that is seen as sheer lunacy. That to argue that what we need is more guns out there to arm teachers, to arm students, what's next? Arm daycare workers, pastors in churches. The reality is that in places where we used to feel safe, from schools to malls, right down the line, we don't feel safe anymore. And the reason we don't feel safe is the easy access to guns. And I think what we need to do is really reassess our nation's firearms policy. And we need to talk about the fact that groups like the National Rifle Association are actively working to develop a youth gun culture. And if you accept the youth gun culture as defined and hoped for by the NRA and the firearms industry, these things are going to happen. And I think another important point is the fact that the gun culture itself in America is changing. It's shrinking and at the same time becoming more extreme. The old culture of hunting and the shooting sports is changing into an anti-government, an anti-authority culture, whereas guns are not seen as tools of sport but of self-defense. And I think what we're finding from the language of NRA President Charlton Heston, who has made racist, homophobic statements, is that you're seeing an isolated culture, and things like this are the natural result of that culture.
Well, Josh, we're also joined by Vince Schiraldi from the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, who's done a report on schoolhouse shootings. And Vince, can you give us your estimate or sense of this latest shooting and how it relates to the report you've already done?
Sure. I just want to chime in on something Josh just said, which is that, you know, I grew up in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which is sort of a semi-tough blue-collar neighborhood, and I always had good grades. I got picked on all the time by the jocks in my school, as did lots of other kids that got good grades and lots of other kids that just didn't fit in. And, you know, back to the days of Rebel Without a Cause and, you know, in our popular culture forever, the notion that some kids get picked on by other kids is replete. The difference is that back then, people didn't have access to semi-automatic weapons. Today's young people, it's in so many ways, are better behaved than we were 20-plus years ago. If you look at surveys of students back in the 70s, they were assaulted more back in the 70s than they are today by other students. They took more drugs. They engaged in premarital sex more. They were less religious in the 70s than they are today. The big difference is today's kids have access to all forms of guns in exponentially greater numbers. About a third of high school students say it'd be easy for them to put their hands on a gun. And that's the big difference. Not that the kids are any meaner, more violent. In fact, there's a decent body of evidence that says they're less violent today than they were back then, but that violence has turned more lethal due to access to guns. So I want to echo that. Having said that, I do want to remind Americans that it is still extraordinarily unlikely that anyone will be shot in a school in America. In fact, America's schools are still one of the safest places to be in the country. There's less than a 1 in a million chance you'll get shot in a school. 99.4% of killings of children in America occur outside of schools. So they're still very safe places. They're made idiosyncratically less safe by access to weapons and increasingly weapons that can fire multiple shots.
Vince, what about the whole issue of how this breaks down racially? In the 1980s, as there was a huge growth of violence in the inner cities, the reaction of most Americans was tougher sentencing laws. Now, in the last couple of years, as we've seen these spates of violence in white schools all around the country, suddenly there's this anguish. What's happening to our country? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things I calculated last year was that during the period of time when those five different highly publicized school shootings occurred, in which 11 children were killed, 11 white children, there were about 900, likely that there were about 900 black children killed in throughout America in cities and neighborhoods that got very little publicity. In fact, my office manager's granddaughter was strangled to death the day before one of the big school shootings occurred, and it got a little footnote at the end of the Washington Post. She was a three-year-old baby. African-American baby, and then, of course, actually, there was a shooting in Richmond, Virginia, like 2 days later that didn't even result in a fatality, and it got front-page coverage. So it's very clear that the media has focused on this. I think part of the reason is that that's because it's white kids killing white kids, and the media considers that unusual, and what is unusual is what gets media coverage. And I think that's very problematic from the standpoint of setting public policy. I mean, 11 kids die every 2 days at the hands of their parents. 11 kids were killed in all of those school shootings last year combined. And if the school shootings have the result of making Americans believe that America's juvenile homicide problem is best depicted by white rural kids in schools, it will have done a tremendous disservice to public policy setting. That's not where our kids are in danger. Our kids are in danger in our inner cities, and increasingly that's isolated to minority kids. 25% of America's juvenile homicides occurred in just four cities last year, New York, L.A., Chicago, and Detroit. So as we set public policy in response to this, we need to be very careful that it affects the real problem of juvenile homicides by and of juveniles. And that's not predominantly a rural white school problem. That's predominantly an inner city, in the streets problem.
Vince Giraldi with the Justice Policy Institute, who has recently put out a report on schoolhouse shootings. I just wanted to comment quickly. My colleague Robert Knight did a quick internet search of the census in Littleton, Colorado, to give a sense of that community. About 32,000 people in the community overall. Most of them are white. The overwhelming number of them are white. 296 African Americans in the community. As for Asians and Pacific Islanders, about double that. around 500, and about 1,700 Latinos. So it is overwhelmingly a white community. But it is interesting to note that even within that, in the suburban community, something that wasn't highlighted in the networks was that kids of color, as the kids put it, kids of color were targeted. I could only think that if it was the other way and these were black students who had targeted white kids, that the headlines in every paper would be a quote that said, because they were white. And we're not getting that kind of stress right now. I bet a lot of people are listening are surprised to know that there was any kind of targeting. Isolde Rafferty, still with us, 17 years old from Garfield High School. You are part of the group Save Students Against Violence Everywhere that was founded after a shooting in your school. Now, is it true that since that time in 1995 that more kids have taken up weapons, even kids from the group?
Oh, well, what I said yesterday was, yeah, I think kids within our group come from families who do have guns. And I know that a lot of times, how do I want to put this? Yeah, generally kids will advocate peace but have guns within their home, and it just goes to show how many people do have guns. Now, I do go to an inner city public school, which could contribute to that fact, like the guy earlier said, that's where a lot of homicides are. But I don't, yeah, that is true. I don't think that since the shooting, I don't think the shooting has spurned that, but I think that's a fact that's been going on for a while, that a lot of people have guns, a lot of people within my school have guns, a lot of people are scared. People don't want to hang out after school for too long. They feel it's dangerous.
And Isolde, is it true that there have been two serious beatings in your school just this year, so that some level of violence continues?
Oh, violence, definitely. People are scared at my school. Yeah, there are two in the past 2 months, some pretty brutal beatings. One kid at 10:30 in the morning in the school bathroom, so that was on school grounds. Five kids beat him up. And a little while ago, I'd say about 2 weeks ago, a kid got brutally beat up after his baseball practice and suffered a concussion and had to go to the emergency room. So it's not really safe, and I wish it were. But then again, I think we try to blame it on the kids, and it's not our fault, and I know that. And they want, like, now they're trying to pass laws to try us as adults. And I want to say, you know, you never treat us as adults before. We do something stupid, and now we're going to be tried as adults. I think somebody needs to step in and look at what's really going on. So, yeah, beatings are, you know, in beatings, one person gets beat up, two people get beat up. When someone has access to guns, many people get killed. And that's when someone needs to open their eyes and say, what's going on?
I wanted to ask Patrick Sheehan, also 17, from Norwich Academy in Norwich, Connecticut, about your group Youth Peace, focusing on violent influences on young people like militarism and TV violence. In a minute, we're going to talk about, obviously, the irony with President Clinton going on national television last night and saying young people have to be told that they should resolve their conflicts with words, not weapons, as bombs fall on Belgrade, and they're from the United States. But what about that connection between militarism, between war that U.S. is involved with, and violence at home, Patrick?
Well, I see the connection as very obvious, that they promote the use of words to solve your problems, but then they don't use words and they just bomb. It's illegal in this country to kill one person, but it's foreign policy to kill 100,000 people. It's I see it in the schools and through you see all the violence around you with the weapons and the recruiters always asking you, what do you want to do with your future? And I see the need to solve the problems of the school fighting, school shooting, is nonviolence in earlier years, too. When kids have problems and all they see is violent solutions, they're going to come up with violent solutions. And through the use of nonviolence and conflict resolution, violence disintegrates.
What about war toys?
War toys, I feel that with war toys, they teach kids at an early age to use violence to solve their problems, because some people make the argument it's just toys, but you learn from what's around you. And if you're watching G.I. Joe and playing with G.I. Joes, and you see how much of a hero he is, you want to become G.I. Joe. And he solves his problems by killing other people and bombing Belgrade. And that's what kind of solution we're going to come up with in our high schools.
And, Patrick, when the military comes to your high school to recruit, what does your organization do?
We have set up a alternatives to the military table at NFA, or my school, Norwich Free Academy, where under Supreme Court ruling, any high school that has recruiters come to their school, they can have people come to the school and express to the kids what the recruiters won't tell you, because recruiters lie a lot to the kids, from my experience, and unless it's on writing, they can't get in trouble for it. When they come to the college fairs, me and a few other students from Youth Peace go and talk to them around the crowds about going and killing people for college money, and just various awareness issues on the lies that the recruiters tell the people.
Patrick Sheehan of Youth Peace in Norwich, Connecticut. He's at the Norwich Academy in Connecticut,
Can I make a comment,
Amy? Vince Schiraldi?
Yeah, I just want to say, listening to those two young people that spoke, a lot of politicians, particularly last year, really made a lot of hay about these school shootings, and they tried to depict all of America's teenagers as Luke Woodham and Kip Kinkle, and then tried to pass some really nasty lock them up with adult laws on the backs of that. And I think that these two people that just spoke, as well as most of the images we saw yesterday of young people on the other side of that yellow tape weeping over the death of their classmates, we need to remind ourselves that that's what America's young people are. They're the people on the other side of the tape crying over the death of those young, of their classmates, just like all the rest of us did. They're not Luke Woodham any more than adults are stereotyped by Charles Manson. And when we set public policy, we need to remember that there's much more hope to be had in our young people than despair, despite the act of a handful of kids.
But unfortunately, Vincent, speaking for the many of my colleagues in the mass media, and I was seeing it again yesterday in the coverage, they seem to thrive on keeping the country insecure so that the headlines become, this could happen anywhere, it could happen at any school, and it's part of this this pattern of somehow that if the mass media keep the public insecure and worried, they'll be more likely to keep watching and keep reading, and unfortunately don't help to provide the kind of solutions and the kind of perspective that you're suggesting.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been to CNN studios, but I was just there yesterday doing a couple of quick interviews, and as you walk down the hallway, there's a really pretty multicolored graph that adorns the wall with big spikes shooting up in it for their ratings following major national and international crises like the wars, of course, the OJ decision, and the school shootings. There are spikes at every moment, and they label them proudly. I think you're right. I think these types of crises pay, and I think that they give the public bad information. Last year, after those school shootings, more than two-thirds of Americans thought a school shooting was likely in their community, which means not only were they wrong, but that they were profoundly and exponentially wrong, because they were no more likely to have a school shooting last year than they were 5 years ago, and 5 years ago and last year, they were extraordinarily unlikely to have a school shooting. So the media is our nation's educator on the issue of violence, because most people know what they know about violence from the media, not from personal experience. And the media is a very bad teacher.
Just to underscore your point, Vince, of before, it's not that kids are more violent, it's that they have access to more violent means to express themselves, and we're talking about guns. And again, for people saying there was no way to predict, let's go to the kids of Littleton, Colorado, who were running out of that school and talking about that clique, the trench coat mafia. One of them saying that in the video production class, one of these guys, part of that clique, had videos made of himself holding guns. There are warning signs, and there are serious public policy issues that have to do with guns. I want to just give a chance for everyone to give out their phone number because you're all involved in very important groups. Vince Schiraldi, Justice Policy Institute, who put out the report on schoolhouse shootings. Your number?
It's 202-678-9282, and you can download the study from our website at www.cjcj.org.
And Josh Sugarman, Executive Director of the Violence Policy Center, that's monitoring the gun laws and the changes in them in state to state.
The Violence Policy Center's phone number is 202-822-8200. Also, we have a website located at www.vpc.org. In addition to information regarding laws and such, we have a great deal of information on the gun industry, its efforts of marketing guns to kids, and NRA efforts to market guns to kids and also create what we call sort of a new gun culture that has turned its back on hunting and shooting and more towards this growing isolationism.
And I wanted to end with the students, Patrick and Isold. I don't know if you want to give out a number, but Patrick Sheehan, you are with the group Youth Peace. Is there a phone number for your group in Norwich, Connecticut?
Yes. The phone number is 860-889-5337, and that's connected with the War Resisters League. There's also a website. I don't have the address on me.
Well, if it's the War Resisters League, I think it's www.wrl.org. And finally, Isold Rafferty of Garfield High School. You know violence there well, having shooting in 1995. Your group, Students Against Violence Everywhere, or SAVE?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our number is 1-800-897-7697, and our internet address is through Mavia, which is Mothers Against Violence in America, www.mavia.org.
That's
M-A-V-I-A.
www.mavia.org.
Right.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Isold Rafferty, Patrick Sheehan, Vincent Schiraldi, Josh Sugarman, and Mark Potok, who was with us before of the Southern Poverty Law Center. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go from covering violence at home to covering it abroad. Stay with us.
You can be what you want to be. You can act like you want to act. But this does not mean that you lose the fever of the scheme that makes you you. I said you can be what you want to be. You can act like you want to act. But this does not mean that you lose the fever of the scheme that makes you you. So what you gonna do, baby? Just what you gonna do? Supply has no monopoly insurance.
I must be proud of Judaism.
And the water is filled with parasites. The ideology.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue with the coverage of violence. We move from the Littleton School in Denver, Colorado, a suburban Denver school, to the bombing of Kosovo, the bombing overall of Yugoslavia. As the bombs continue to fall on Yugoslavia, we'll address the media coverage of the war, both in the U.S. and as well in Britain, who is closely following the U.S. lead. Norman Solomon is with us. He is formerly with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and still associated with them. And he also has written a book on media coverage, many of them. His latest one is called The Habits of the Highly Deceptive Media, Decoding Spin and Lies in Mainstream News. Norman, if you could make some connections here by the kind of coverage we're seeing of the school shooting and what we're seeing in Yugoslavia.
There's a pattern that's gone on, I think, for many decades in the U.S. mass media, and it could be summarized this way. There are worthy victims and unworthy victims. There are certain people who suffer violence, and quite appropriately, very often, their suffering and the anguish of the loved ones is depicted in great detail. But other people are simply unworthy, and especially unworthy of empathetic media attention if their suffering is connected to U.S. tax dollars and the U.S. military. So, you know, as it happens, the tragedy in Colorado occurred simultaneously with NATO warplanes flying what they call missions, 603 of them in the 24-hour period that just ended. So the assault on Yugoslavia, which certainly is terrorizing people in that country in an analogous way in many respects to what people have endured at those at the school in Colorado, this kind of bombing is simply ignored in the U.S. mass media in terms of the victimization of the people at the other end of those bombs.
Well, Norman, what about the way the coverage has gone previous to this to the crisis and the bombing campaign here? For instance, the coverage of the Kosovo of the Kosovar people and their self-determination battle over the last several years versus what it is now, and the coverage of the Serbs and the turning of the Serbs into this incredible enemy now.
Well, so much of what we're getting is policy driven out of the White House and the State Department, and almost in a Pavlovian way, the U.S. news media will humanize the victims of the announced enemies of the United States government, but will dehumanize or ignore the victims of the U.S. government. So you had back in 1995 in the Krajina, the attacks on the Serbs by the Croats, but since the United States government green-lighted those atrocities in which Misha Glenny of the BBC said that Serbs were being shot, quote, like rabbits, unquote, on a large scale. I mean, that didn't register on the U.S. Media screen, and it's not that there's something wrong with sympathetic and empathetic coverage of what people in Kosovo have endured. The problem is the selectivity puts that coverage in a context of propaganda. So even depicting truth in a wider context of that Orwellian selectivity is part of a pattern of coverage which lies to the U.S. population and encourages us to respond in exactly the way and at exactly the time that the U.S. government wants us to. I mean, you've got a very clear example vis-a-vis Kurds. I mean, when Kurds are slaughtered, that is a human tragedy that should outrage us, and we should try to do something about it. But the U.S. mass media have been very sympathetic when Kurds have been slaughtered inside Iraq and have turned a blind eye when Kurds have been slaughtered inside Turkey. And, of course, Turkey is a regime that not only is bombing and torturing their own Kurdish population, but meanwhile is being hailed as a participant in this righteous exercise of bombing the country of Yugoslavia.
And certainly in the case of East Timor right now, the Indonesian military continuing there, 200,000 people killed, as the U.S. talks about being the shield in Yugoslavia. We are the sword in East Timor because we arm and finance the Indonesian military, and that is continuing, something that Noam Chomsky and others have very much focused on, along with the Turkish Kurds. Now, Norman Solomon, in terms of the protests and those that point these kind of issues out, like Saeed, like Noam Chomsky, like all the different peace groups, Peace Action, War Resisters League, International Action Center, Fellowship of Reconciliation, we're seeing almost none of them in the media. On April 7th, you wrote a piece about this. CNN's Bill Schneider offered this analysis of the anti-war sentiment in the country. What's missing from the Kosovo story is anti-war protest, at least on left. Schneider continued by saying there's no action out there on the streets or on campuses, no marches, no demonstrations, no teach-ins. And I thought, we're doing an awful lot of fabricating on Democracy Now! Then.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that, the fact that it's not that there's no protest, but there's no media covering it?
Well, you know, progressive people who are organizing and speaking out against this war are being depicted by default as being silent. In fact, they're being silenced. They're not getting much access to the news media. And there are exceptions. I mean, I had a few minutes on CNN to talk about the media slanting of the war a couple of weeks back. But the essence of propaganda is repetition, and for every few moments that progressive voices can be heard in the mass media, there is hour after hour and day after day of the parade of generals and pundits and cheerleaders for this war effort. Meanwhile, as we've been talking about, the pieties that are put forward by President Clinton about the war, about the need to avoid violence and so forth, and last night him saying that our prayers should go out to the victims and their families in Colorado is just in total contrast to the insistence of what we might call the military-industrial media complex to refuse to acknowledge not only the suffering of the people at the other end of NATO missiles, but also the very strong moral revulsion that exists inside the United States and other NATO countries. Millions of people who are outraged, who want to challenge what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism that is running out of control and rampant in our society and over the skies of Yugoslavia. But the mass media, just as they ignore and slant the minimal coverage of the peace movement that exists today, the news media are eagerly continuing to selectively depict, when they mention at all, Dr. King, who denounced the madness of militarism and now is simply being relegated to the role of a dreamer, a martyr on a postage stamp.
And of course, when you mention this the slanting of coverage, for instance, we had this week the example of the first American casualty, really, of this war occurring on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, as two planes practicing for heading to the Balkans end up exploding a bomb and killing a Puerto Rican on the island of Vieques. And that's gotten almost very little coverage so far.
Yeah, I think it's very important to the war planners and the war makers to encourage the news media, which largely cooperate, to tell Americans that we can maintain our innocence. All of this foggy language about air campaign and collateral damage and so forth are euphemisms to just keep persuading us that we are innocent, that we can somehow detach ourselves from what's being done in our name. And, of course, there's this overlay of moralistic rationales for this bombing, which, of course, are refuted by the realities on the ground, even when measured against the announced aims of NATO, which were undertaken, we were told, 28 days ago. I'm reminded that when Madeleine Albright was nominated as Secretary of State at the end of 1996, she said, and I quote, "We are not a charity or a fire department. We will defend firmly our own vital interests," unquote. Now, there's the problem of what our vital interests are and who our is. And there's Wall Street's interests and there are other interests. But there's also, I think, a key point that the mass media will not examine. The cover of Newsweek last week had Milosevic on it and said, "The face of evil, his mind and motives." And the mass media love to deconstruct the motives of Milosevic, but will not do so in terms of Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright and so forth. Let's take Albright at her word. When she says the U.S. is not a charity or a fire department, she's saying precisely that the United States will not intervene or take action for humanistic or rescue reasons. The U.S. will, in her own words, quote, "defend firmly our own vital interests," and yet probing what those motives really are, the economic and geopolitical motives of the United States, is really a virtual taboo in U.S. mass media.
Norman Solomon, who is a fierce media critic and author of the book, The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media, Decoding Spin and Lies in Mainstream News. And we're going to continue to decode the spin, especially when it comes to the U.S. media's coverage of the war in Yugoslavia. And we're going to look at journalists and talk to them around the world in coming days about what they're doing. And we'll look at Britain as well and what another NATO country's journalists are doing. But today we wanted to end the show in a different way. Norman is talking about how the media rallies around the flag in a time of war, and we want to end by specifically talking about the flag. Yesterday, there was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the proposed Flag Protection Constitutional Amendment, and one of the people who spoke out against a Flag Protection Constitutional Amendment was Gary May. Gary May is Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Southern Indiana, but he's also a Vietnam War veteran who lost his legs in Vietnam. And he said, though, that he didn't fight to preserve, he didn't fight for something like a Flag Protection Constitutional Amendment. Gary May, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Can you talk about what this means?
Well, I think the proposed amendment would have a very chilling effect on speech, especially speech that would be at variance with policy. And it's been, I think, one of the protected freedoms in our country that free speech is one of the essential constitutional rights that we've all come to expect and prosper under. If passed, this amendment would, in effect, prohibit speech that used an icon that represents our freedoms in the speech itself. That is to say that it would prohibit the yet to be defined desecration of the flag and render people who you would desecrate the flag to be criminals. I thought it was interesting, though, that in the testimony yesterday when the question was put to the proponents as to what they would suggest as the way, appropriate punishment, they indicated that treating such an offense as a traffic violation might be in order. And it strikes me as a bit absurd that such an important undertaking, changing the Constitution, would warrant a penalty akin to a parking violation or a moving violation in a motor vehicle. And I think the public needs to be fully aware that this proposed amendment is moving with great dispatch. Senator Hatch yesterday in his comments indicated that the bill will be marked up very soon. And this is an issue that has been brought up many times in the past few years. And I'm concerned that people who are very concerned about this may have been sort of desensitized or lulled into complacency. The time for action is now. And people who are very concerned and oppose this amendment need to make their voices heard right now and without delay. We need to speak up and to express the concerns, legitimate concerns that we have based on our love for our country and our concerns about the implications of this amendment as it pertains to our ability to express disagreement.
And when politicians get up and say people died for that flag, we're not going to watch it burn, your response?
Well, I lost my legs, as you pointed out, in Vietnam, in service to my country. I'm proud of that. I think the cause, at least in my case, the Vietnam War, certainly was dubious at best. But that notwithstanding, I did what I did as an 18-year-old because I believed that it was my duty to do so. That's the way I had been raised. I had been raised, you know, in an environment of embracing traditional values. And again, I'm proud of that. But to reduce that allegiance, to reduce that service to a piece of cloth, I think is in some ways insulting. And it trivializes, as I testified yesterday, my sacrifices and the sacrifices of others.
Well, Gary May, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And tomorrow we will give out the phone number that you suggest for people to find more out about this Flag Protection Constitutional Amendment that is being pushed through very quickly. That does it for the show. If people want to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love, Errol Maitland and Joe Gill. Our engineers, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. Listening.